You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters Live.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Table Talk. Today we'll be hearing from buyers and brands battling to keep up with the demand for clean, sustainable and plant-based products. What innovations are out there and what buyers are looking for to fill the gaps in the market. I'm Jo Kirkland, and today we'll be hearing insights from Carol Bingley at RSSL, looking specifically at how food producers are responding to the demands of clean label.
So I think this whole flexitarian market has opened up a new area of development, and we're seeing not just the usual burgers and sausages, which everyone's very used to, but we're seeing a lot more development and bringing in new ingredients.
Jennifer Pardo from PB&Co and the founders of plantiful food company Adam and Becca Courtney tell us about the types of consumers that are buying into the brand that are essentially clean.
If you show a consumer every stage of the process, hopefully that gives the consumer more confidence in what that brand stands for. So yes, they'll look at the back of the packet to see what ingredients are in there, but they don't necessarily need to because they trust that that brand represents good values and will probably have good ingredients in there too.
So let's jump straight in. Here with me, keeping it clean in every sense, are Carol Bingley. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Jennifer Pardo.
Hi.
And Adam and Becca Courtney.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for joining me. So let's dive straight in with what does clean label really mean? Carol, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, there's no real definition of clean label, and it is very much in the eye of the consumer. But we're seeing that consumers are looking for ingredients that they can recognise and they can pronounce. And also, it also moves into the number of ingredients on the back of pack. They don't want to see a big, long list of ingredients. In the eyes of the consumer, the fewer the better.
Yeah, I suppose I feel exactly like that now when I'm looking at products more and more. And if I see lots of technical, scientific words, I'm not that interested. I'm looking for like 6 or 7 products.
Exactly. And some companies are using the term kitchen cupboard logic. So ingredients that consumers would usually see in their own kitchen cupboards and would use when they're preparing foods at home.
Interesting, isn't it? It was kind of like a return to the old days.
Yes. I mean, there's a lot of scaremongering around the use of additives. And originally, the E-number system was set up to show that to consumers that those ingredients were actually safe and had been through a very stringent check to make sure that they were safe for the consumers to eat. That's backfired a little bit, and consumers are now seeing E numbers as something bad and something that they want to avoid. And this is making it more challenging for manufacturers, for developers, to get the functionality that they need in the products whilst avoiding some of these ingredients that consumers don't want to see on the back of packs.
And so what do the consumers actually understand by the term clean label? Is it the same as you all understand as professionals, or do we have a more simple idea of it?
I think the industry has taken the guidance from the consumer. We've realised that although we know these ingredients are safe to use, if the consumer doesn't want to see them on the pack, there's no way that we can continue to use them and just keep telling them they're safe, because the consumers aren't going to accept that. So we are looking to take our guidance from the way the consumers are seeing clean label. And some companies, some of the retailers have drawn up lists of red, amber, green ingredients. So if an ingredient's on the red list for a supplier, then you just have to avoid that. Green, obviously fine to use. Amber, it may depend on the final product.
And what does that? What do the three categories actually mean? What makes a red?
So a red may be something that, for an example, high-potency sweeteners, the synthetic high-potency sweeteners, tend to sit on the red list. And this is a lot around the consumer perception of those ingredients rather than any real toxicological data to say that they're not safe.
So my next question was going to be, does it mean different things to different people as a label? And presumably it does.
I think it does, yes. Yeah, it depends on your own personal viewpoint and your experience of using ingredients, and potentially what you're looking to use the product for. If you're looking for something that's convenient and fits into your day, you may be more accepting of some of the ingredients. Whereas if you're looking for something to fulfill a specific nutritional need in your diet, you may be wanting that to be very very much sticking to those clean label principles. Indulgent products are another area where people are maybe a little bit more forgiving because it's all about the taste and the texture of the product and really enjoying that product, and they may be a little bit more willing to move away from that very strict list of ingredients.
And we're definitely going to come back to that idea of the indulgence and how it feels and tastes in a little while. Adam Becker, tell us a little bit about your story. Everything that I've read, it's really inspiring. You shook off the shackles of your jobs and carved a new path and possibly solved a problem at the same time. So tell us about how you got started with Plantable Food.
Sure. So Becker and I, in case others don't know, we're actually a married couple as well, so that adds another layer of complexity to a normal business partner. We both worked corporate jobs. I worked in property, Becca worked in property, also in investment. And one evening we stumbled across a recommended Netflix documentary called Forks Over Knives, which I'm sure many, many people have watched now. And it really just struck a chord with us. So the next day we said, let's just give this a go. Let's go completely plant-based overnight. And that was almost about 2.5 years ago now. And we haven't looked back. And we found we had great health benefits. We just felt lighter, had more energy. And we just really enjoyed the feeling. So that Christmas after watching the documentary, we went to Australia on holiday. And before that, we'd been preparing all these vegan meals at home, not really understanding or have even heard of the ingredients we were using before. And it was taking us a lot of time after our day jobs. And in Australia, they had so many options for vegans and plant-based eaters out there. So we came back and we said, look, let's do this. We need to put something to the market where it's easy and accessible for people working long hours and jobs to just have access to plant-based food. And that's sort of how we founded the company.
So in Australia, was there already a high demand for it, or is it just the way that they eat already?
I think there's probably a bit of both. I don't know if it's because there's a lot more health and fitness in Australia and the weather's better, so people are outside more. But for whatever the reason was, there were just the restaurants and the supermarkets had a lot more options. So we just saw that as a great sign that the UK is lacking that, and we think there's a great opportunity to do something great.
And now the UK industry is really starting to demand this kind of thing more and more. So do you think that the UK culture around food is creating more demand for clean labels than in other countries now?
Well, certainly the UK market now, in terms of veganism and plant-based eating, seems to be one of the fastest growing, if not the leading country now in the world.
Well done for getting yourselves involved in this stage.
Yeah, very fortuitous on our part. I think what consumers understand now as clean label is very different. So we started off by making our food by just using ingredients in our cupboard, and also we worked with Jen developing some early recipes. And I think it's not just about what is on the label that's important to consumers now, it's more about the overall brand, how honest and how much feedback does a brand give to the consumer. We try to be very honest with our brand ethos and how much we communicate to the consumer as well. And hopefully the consumers can buy into that and understand where companies are coming from. So if they trust the brand, they will trust the labels, and that sort of follows.
Yeah. So Jen, tell us a little bit about your work and background.
So previously I'd owned a food-to-go chain, a premium sandwich chain in London. And this is in 2012, we really noticed a big increase in demand from our customers, and our customers were city workers, for healthier foods. And back then, less fat and lower calories. And I started developing plant-based products back then, and we were the first to put plant-based milks on the shelf as a food to go. Mm. Back then, they were really only available in supermarkets. We're very proud to do that, and we saw the demand increase, and customers were very happy with products that didn't have meat and dairy. So it really started from there, and the growing awareness of health and environment too. I think in 2010 there was a UN report about the climate change and the effects that animal agriculture was having on that. So that really combined, and I went on to specialise in plant-based product development. We can really see the market growing, and since then I've worked with many brands, including Adam and Becker's Plantiful brands, and developing the products, helping to scale up, and business support.
So Carol, talk to us a little bit about RSSL and your work there.
Okay, so RSSL is a scientific consultancy, and we offer analytical and product development services to the food and pharmaceutical industries. I work in the product development department, so I support companies looking to develop new products or ingredient companies looking to understand more about their ingredients and how they can be used by the food industry.
Okay. So how are food producers responding to the demands of clean label?
Yeah, so we're definitely seeing a response to the demands of clean label. And as Jen's just said, within the briefs we receive, we're asked to keep the label as clean as possible and avoid additives or ingredients which have names that the consumers may not be familiar with. And it does make it more challenging, particularly when you're thinking about trying to develop products which maybe are taking taste and texture into a new area. Mm. And I'm thinking about the products which are probably more targeted towards the flexitarian consumers. So attracting those people who are looking for the taste and the texture of meat, but at the same time looking for a product which contains no animal protein. And that's a challenge to do that. And it's a challenge to do it. It's even a harder challenge to do it if you then start to avoid certain ingredients such as hydrocolloids, which may help to provide that the bite and the binding characteristics, help the product to survive during cooking without falling to pieces. It's really difficult to marry up those two requests, really.
How do you do that?
By looking for different ingredients and understanding the functionality of those ingredients in the product and what you're looking for them to do can help you then to look for alternatives which may be considered more acceptable on the back of pack, looking for maybe fibre-derived ingredients that can help you with the binding, looking for ingredients that are produced more naturally in products. So seaweed is used as a source for a number of different hydrocolloids, but they do go through a process to achieve the ingredients that we've used traditionally. But there may be ways of using the raw material in a way that helps to provide that mouthfeel or that texture that we're looking for.
And what are the priorities from your perspective at RSSL?
The priorities, I think taste and texture will always be top priority, because no matter how nutritionally balanced or sustainable or clean label the product is, it's got to taste really good, because otherwise the consumer won't keep coming back and buying the product. So really achieving that great taste. And I think for different sectors of the population, that means different things. So for a person who's moved to a vegan diet, they may be more adventurous and more willing to accept new tastes and textures, and probably not necessarily looking to replicate the meat or the dairy that they've removed from their diet. But far larger is the flexitarian opportunity. So a lot of companies are very interested in that as a way of marketing these products. So then we are looking to go down that route of matching taste and texture to the meat or dairy alternative. And at best, plant proteins can be bland. Mm. And often they do bring some off tastes or undesirable flavours into the product. So we're looking to try and mask those flavours or work with them to try and create something that tastes as good as the product that's being replaced.
And Adam and Becca, how are product manufacturers responding to consumer demand, and what are they looking for in terms of natural ingredients? What have you found out in your research?
Yeah, sure. So I think consumers want something that tastes really good. And, you know, if we look at our product development so far, we've had to be kind of one step ahead of all of the other retailers, because you do see them stepping up to the ballpark in terms of developing their own products as well. So one of the things, for instance, that we've done is we started out with some vegan mac and cheese in our ready meals. And then halfway through last year, we released a new range of 5-a-day pots. So these are veg pots that are perfect for lunch or dinner, and each of them have 5 servings of fruit and veg. So that really targets the flexitarian market for us in terms of giving them something that's healthy and fulfills all their, you know, vegetable needs and hits kind of all the check marks in terms of clean label. But definitely the goal in terms of for us in product manufacturing and development is to make exciting new products that also kind of check the boxes in terms of health and being vegan.
So that, I mean, poses quite a lot of challenges to product development, I'm presuming. Carol and Jen, thoughts on that?
Well, again, the taste is king, price is queen, and everything else is positioning. Yeah, it has to be the taste and the texture as the top. And the challenges is to then take it to a manufacturer that can take that prototype and make it also taste as good, close to as good as that prototype. I think Becca and Adam first had their feedback at their, they had their mac and cheese at their wedding, actually, wow. As I remember. But it's just really, really finding that, that opportunity to get as many people as possible from different, from your target audience. But it's really valuable because you get feedback that you hadn't thought of before. It's really important, and you can that could really, you know, make some adjustments to the recipe.
Becca and Adam, that's brave. Did you ask the caterers to keep every plate and see what had been eaten, or did you put a questionnaire on each round table?
I don't know if we did a questionnaire. We certainly asked people afterwards, but I think the trouble is people are never going to be 100% honest. But it was certainly a novelty. We wanted to try it, and we didn't tell people it was vegan, and lots of people didn't realise until afterwards, so that was a good sign for us.
Yeah, we tried to also not tell them that it was our product as well, so yeah. We tried to make it kind of secretive and kind of go around the tables and see how much had been eaten afterwards.
Conscientious behaviour.
Your wedding day.
And Carol, what innovations are coming through the new product development process? Are there challenges and barriers and opportunities in this area?
Yeah, so I think we are seeing new products. I think this whole flexitarian market has opened up a new area of development, and we're seeing not just the usual burgers and sausages, which everyone's very used to, but we're seeing a lot more development and bringing in new ingredients. So things like jackfruit, which, you know, probably a couple of years ago, very few people had heard about. There's banana blossom being used in fish alternatives, so battered and used in fish and chips. And we're seeing a lot of development from the ingredient suppliers as well to meet this new challenge, and new sources of protein coming through. So taking from the ones we're all familiar with, so things like soya, pea, fava beans are very good sources of protein at the moment, but right through to things like hemp, tomato seed, cotton seed, lots of new proteins being developed by the suppliers to be able to use in different ways and help us create new products. I went to an exhibition just at the weekend and looked around, and there were some fantastic new ideas. And product I saw was popped lotus seeds as an alternative to popcorn. And these are a source of protein as well. So it's a, you know, an on-the-go snack, but also providing sort of a nutritional benefit. So I think there's so much work going on at the moment.
And tell us a bit about the science and the tools. It feels like it would be lots of people in lab coats extracting things with exciting looking tools. Tell us about that.
Yes. And
tell us about the future.
There is that side of it, although, again, being very mindful of the end consumer, wanting the ingredient to be as natural as possible. Mm. So the extraction techniques being used are as natural as possible in terms of using water extraction, using enzymes, moving away from any sort of solvents or anything which may have a polluting effect. So being able to tell that story to your consumer about how the product is grown, how it's processed, and how it finds its way into the final product is really important to the consumer, and building that story around your brand as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because it feels to me like a futuristic thing, something from a science fiction film or a Margaret Atwood novel, and the connotation therefore seems that it would be fake in some way. So how does it adhere to the clean label needs of the consumer?
Yeah. Well, yes, and as I say, ingredient suppliers are very aware of that need, and they are producing nice sort of little infographics to show how the materials are produced, to be able to reassure your consumers that you're not using these weird and wonderful ingredients that maybe they wouldn't trust and they would be put off by. So,
well, I suppose that's going to add more ingredients to the back again, which is what you're hoping to avoid.
Yeah.
And in terms of barriers, are you coming up against it in terms of the tools that can be used? Presumably they can only innovate as fast as science and technology allows.
I don't think we're coming up against it. I think at the moment it's really exciting. I think we've got consumers wanting to try new products, so we've got a pull from the consumer, but we've also got a push from the ingredient suppliers in terms of they're coming up with some of these new ingredients that we can then try and look at and see where we can innovate in terms of using those ingredients and finding the best ways of putting those into products. So I think there's a push-pull, and it's growing all the time.
Exciting time to be involved. And to all of you, how does the consumer react when their trusted brands are changed? So chocolate bars getting smaller or a sugar replacement being used in a well-known, I'm sticking with chocolate, but chocolate on the brain, naughty, think about carrots. How do they react when something that they've trusted is changing?
Chocolate bars getting smaller is always bad news, isn't
it? Just us getting bigger.
That's my tool.
Yeah, and there is that sweet spot of how far can you reduce the portion size of something before somebody just then goes and eats two, because clearly that's not going to achieve the nutritional goals that we're setting. But for something that is a treat, often people do kind of say, don't touch my chocolate, I want to enjoy it. And maybe it is just finding ways to encourage them to eat that in a more mindful and responsible way, rather than selling a great big bar that, you know, even with the best will in the world, it's quite easy to sit and scoff most of that in one sitting.
100%.
But obviously the other route is to modify the formulation in some way to reduce the sugar and, more importantly, the calories in the product. And it's finding clean label ways of doing that. No added sugar has been around for a long time, but mainly based on polyol ingredients. These are hydrogenated. They start with sugars, but they go through a hydrogenation process, which makes them less digestible. And they have an ol on the end of them. And again, consumers don't really know what that means. They're a little bit suspicious of those ingredients. In addition, you have to put a lactation warning on pack if they exceed a certain percentage in the formulation. Not ideal from your clean label perspective. But from a food technologist's point of view, they're great. They taste sweet. They perform the same sort of functions as sugar would in the product. So we've had to be very creative to avoid using those sorts of ingredients and yet achieve these nutritional goals that we're looking to try and achieve for some of these indulgent products.
Lots of nodding from Jen over there. Anything to add?
I completely agree. I think also the consumer, news moves so fast and, consumers are still accepting. I don't think it would stop them buying something just because it became smaller. It's just an annoyance that, you know, that the product is being made smaller but hopefully not made more expensive. However, there's so many products on the market of all different sizes at the moment. So, you might have a seed ball is much, much smaller than a Mars bar. Yeah. And I think that's just, there's just so many products out there versus the traditional products that I think overall, consumers are accepting of change and they would, do understand the reasons why.
It'd be nice if we got to the stage, wouldn't it, where by the tills are all of the healthy, clean products and the chocolate bars and the biscuits are in a different aisle. Because I find that the hardest thing, getting to, like, the till in the petrol station without looking right or left at all, my blinkers. Adam, how do you see the market developing in clean label foods?
I certainly think there's a trend towards more clean label foods. We try to keep ours as clean as possible. I think for a lot of companies, commerciality is definitely a factor. Mm. So we come up against that where we're using clean label, we're using natural ingredients, but other companies either have access to other ingredients or they choose to use it to make their margins better. And that's certainly an obstacle where I think it almost needs a bit of potentially legislation to stop people using bad ingredients, let's call them, where they're not necessarily good for people and they're just making things cheaper without, when there could be a healthier substitute.
Well, I was talking to someone the other day who's looking for literally that, for the legislation to change. So that, yeah, it has to happen that way. And Becca, how has the response been to Plantiful so far?
Yeah, really good. So this is actually our 1 year anniversary since we launched.
Congratulations.
This month. Thanks. So as I mentioned, we've come up with, so we launched with 4 vegan ready meals, 2 of which were developed partly by Jen, which was our creamy mac and our gluten-free creamy mac. So those are our best sellers. And then halfway through last year, we released another set of ready meals, the 5-a-day pots. And then just earlier this year, we've released some vegan jerkies. So these are kind of what you would think of when you think of beef jerky or meat jerky, but they're made entirely from plants and vegetables. We think they're quite clean label and that they don't have any additives or preservatives. And, you know, they're high in protein. So those have been really, really popular so far. And in the ready meals, we've sold about 30,000 to date in the last year around our retailers. And we're in about 60 retailers in the UK. And I think the really exciting part for us going forward is the export market. We've gotten a ton of demand and interest from European consumers and also in the U.S. So for us to hopefully be able to navigate that despite whatever Brexit challenges there might be is going to be our focus for the next 12 months.
Oh, Brexit. So I suppose it'd be easier if we all just bought the raw ingredient and made everything ourselves. But of course, we live a life where we want convenience. And presumably that's where your marketing comes in, where you get all your 5 a day in one go and it's ready to go.
Yeah, have chocolate for the rest of the day if you want.
Yes, that's just how it works. Yeah. But how, in terms of marketing, do you keep that going and stop people from just going, oh, I don't want to have to spend 20 minutes reading the back of everything. I'm gonna buy the rainbow and turn it into a meal myself.
Yeah, I think that's what I touched on earlier, where I think it's important that brands communicate a very clear and honest message about what they represent and taking people on the path. Us and lots of other startups now communicate from the very first instance where they go to a kitchen and they make the first recipe and then with the first production run. And if you show all that and you're showing the consumer every stage of the process, hopefully that gives the consumer more confidence in what that brand stands for. So yes, they'll look at the back of the packet to see what ingredients are in there, but they also don't necessarily need to, because they trust that that brand represents good things, good values, and will probably have good ingredients in there too.
I hope that does happen across the board, because so often you think that something's a healthy option, and then I did it just the other day. I read the back. I thought, that is no healthier than the other thing. It's just got a packet that makes it look like it's really healthy. And so how do we think it's going to shape the aisles going forwards?
Well, the supermarket buyers have an insatiable appetite for plant-based products, especially if they're done well, taste good, innovative, new to market. They have specialist buyers now and product developers like Claire Richardson and Marks and Spencers. Mm. They've all come out with ranges, big ranges. Waitrose last year adding 50 lines. Marks and Spencer adding 60 lines in their January launch. I mean, it's just incredible.
That's really great, isn't it? So, I mean, that's a lot of the shelves changing to plant-based clean labels. It's great. And we've probably touched on it already, really, but what are buyers looking for in new products, things that are coming up right now? Becca?
Yeah, well, I think I actually went to a roundtable hosted by Mintel about a month ago. And Mintel has, you know, this really amazing depository of brands and research. And they surveyed a lot of consumers to think about what are the different attributes. And there were about 16 different attributes in products that they would look for. And I think buyers look for the same things. And the top three, as Jen has kind of touched on, so the three that you can't make a successful product without is taste and value for money. So that doesn't mean it has to be cheap, but consumers want to feel like they're getting a good value. And then the last one is to be excited about a product. So whether that's, you know, a product that's promising some you know, functional benefit in terms of gut health or, you know, filling your five-a-day needs, or some, you know, really spicy or innovative new ingredient or cuisine. Those three, I think, are the things that us as consumers look for, and also I think what buyers look for.
Did you find that when you were moving into retail that there were challenges that you faced that this kind of thing that you've just been talking about that helped you to develop a product that was going to do well in a retail market?
Yeah, definitely. I think the biggest thing that we struggled with and, you know, we faced was not being everything to everyone. So while we consider ourselves to be clean label, that, you know, as we discussed, has so many different definitions to so many people. So, you know, some consumers want us to be completely gluten-free. Some consumers want us to be completely soy-free. And we can't be all of those things to everyone. So we've really had to learn to stick to our guns in terms of what we stand for as a brand, which is clean in terms of the transparency to the consumer and in terms of the ingredients that we love and find really tasty, and also just being not too dichotomous in terms of the clean versus dirty food thing. I think it can be a little tricky when we talk about clean label in terms of there is a subset of consumers that do it from a health aspect, but some are a little too obsessive over it. So I think, you know, we position ourselves as vegan comfort food, healthy vegan comfort food. So whatever that means to different people, you know, we have to stick to our guns in terms of what our product is.
Sounds delicious to me. I think that that brings us to the end of this podcast. I don't know about anybody else, but I'm going to go home, clear up my cupboards, go to the supermarket, read all the labels, start all over again. My thanks to Jen, Carol, Becca and Adam. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Table Talk podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please share a review. If you like what you've heard, find out more on foodmatterslive.com or find us on Twitter and Facebook.